I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beat and Track Podcast. I'm your host, I'm Stu Whiffin. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. Today's episode, I talked to Bishy and, well, I'm going to say it, it's one of my favourite ever episodes. We go in like, oh my God, I mean, Bishy has done some stuff and what an incredible talker she is as well. You're in for a real treat today. I did not want this natter to finish and something quite unique happens at the end. We talk about her working with Tony Visconti. Well, we don't. We forget to actually talk about her. I make a reference when we're nattering to say, well, we definitely talk about your work with Tony Visconti, which we forgot to do. So we revisited it after we had a chat. And I've dropped that in there as well. It'll all make sense towards the end of the recording anyway. Before we get on with this wonderful chat, just a few thank yous. So thank you to Scroobius Pip and everyone at the Distraction Pieces Network, which this podcast is very proud to be part of. Thanks for 76 for producing this podcast. Thank you very much, mate. And thank you to you lot for continuing to listen and support and say lovely things about this podcast, which is, again, it's my little labour of love where I go and disappear up the shed and press record on Zoom and have some wonderful natters with some absolutely glorious people. And this is definitely one of those. And you're, like I say, you're in for a real treat. If this is your first time listening, then when you get to the end of this ace natter with Bishy, then go and explore the back catalogue because you can hear me talking to artists as diverse as Fatboy Slim, Tommy Lee of Motley Crue, the Foo Fighters, Suede, Idols, Sleaford Mods, Mark Moore, and actors such as Maxine Peake, Joe Hartley, Amanda Abington, Michael Smiley, Thomas Turgoose, producers. We talk about Garbage briefly on this podcast as well. I talked to Butch Vig. That's an amazing episode, talking to Butch. And if you like your comedy, you can hear me talking to Maisie Adam, Jade Adams, Ed Gamble, James Acaster. The list goes on. So go and have a rummage in the archives when you get to the end of this chat. Right, that's enough nattering from me. We're going to head over now and get some ace chat from today's guest. So it gives me great pleasure to introduce Off the Beaten Track Podcast with the wonderful Bishy. Sorry, I've interrupted the podcast, but with good reason. Hotel Chocolat are our sponsors. You know that now because I tell you about it every episode. But they've been super kind now. And you may have heard me talking about the products from the cacao bar and this gins, cream liqueurs, all sorts of wonderful chocolatey goodies. And what they've done is they've set a page up on the website that you can go to. And all you've got to do is just for you Off the Beaten Track listeners, go over there, answer a question, and you could win the full range delivered to your front door. I mean, that's kind of them. All you have to do is go to this place, hotelchocolat.com/OTBT podcast. That's OTBT as in Off the Beaten Track podcast. hotelchocolat.com/OTBT podcast. Go get your grubby little mitts on some deliciously chocolatey drinks, courtesy of our sponsors, Hotel Chocolat. I'll get back to the podcast.
It's Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin.
Okay, we are recording. Bishy, how are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm all right. I'm radiant and glowing. It's the sun is shining today, which is always a nice start to a Friday.
I know. You look glowing. I feel like you're getting the sunlight on your face there.
It is. I've just got it right as well, because I'm in like this little shed at the end of my garden. And normally when I open the blind, I kind of go that really weird sort of transparent, like where I'm just glowing off the sun and like you can't actually see my face. So it's just right now. Actually, it makes me look like I've got a little bit of a tan. I think the white T-shirt's helping. So, yeah, all is good so far. Well, before we get on with your playlist today, I just kind of want to ask you to cast your mind back over the last sort of 17, 18 months and just tell me how you found this odd time. For all of us, I guess, how you found it both personally and creatively?
Well, I think personally, there's been a lot of difficulties, and I think there have been for most people for whatever reason, whether that's family, career, kind of losing people to COVID. There's definitely been a lot of that that's gone on. But creatively, I have found it hugely expansive. And that was completely unexpected. Like that first 3 months was so depressing and surreal for everybody. And I took to my studio and I was actually kind of jamming and experimenting with various pedals. Like I was making a sitar sample pack for a company called Landa. So I kind of got my teeth stuck into that. But I just find myself passing out in the middle of the day, just exhausted from the not knowing. I guess it's like a kind of like depression in a sense. But yeah, I just got together my Women in Tech podcast, and it's been really unexpectedly some opportunities opened up for me. I got some funding, so I'd recorded a single with Tony Visconti and I was able to put that out and do a number of like online events. Like I went through the whole process of how do you deal with an online release, you know? And I ended up in doing an interview with Tony Visconti on the night of the release, and that was really great fun. And yeah, then I ended up doing a digital online Women in Tech Festival, and I got Laurie Anderson to headline that. So it's been really expansive, and I find that people have connected in a way that they couldn't really face-to-face, even though I've really missed. I've missed gigs, I've missed clubs, I have mourned dance floors. I have really missed that bit of cultural life that is so important for musicians and DJs. I managed to turn it around on the digital side of things and on the online sphere.
I think that's what you've just said there, of all the things that you've missed and all of the things that you've then spun off of not being able to do that. That's the kind of punk ethos at its very core that I just get super excited about stuff like that. It's so DIY, isn't it? It's like, right, okay, we can't do this. We can't do this. We can't. Right, what have we got at our disposal here? Right, let's see what we can do with that. And that's where the good stuff comes from.
Exactly, yeah. And I started working with a VR company, so I've understood how to code VR into my Ableton projects, and I've just got like super nerdy and just, you know, I went on music production courses. I kind of upped my skills on so many levels, and I think it's been really relentless and hard for everybody, but that's in a sense what has brought us all together. We're all going through this weirdness together, and really interesting conversations. I've connected with so many artists and had so many brilliant conversations, seen so many panels and things that I just hadn't really seen before. And I'm very much like a girl about town. I like to go out to things. I like to experience things. I'm very interested in other people and what they're going through and what their expression is, be that kind of music or bands or tech or whatever, you know. And so I've really re-engaged with all of that in a way that I never thought was possible. So that's been really exciting, but it's been tough on everyone, hasn't it?
Yeah, totally. But all the things that you said you'd done there, was there a knee jerk, like quickly, as soon as we got told that this thing that was called lockdown was happening, and you know, and all of a sudden, like I run a venue, and that was closed, and it was like, oh god, like the shit's getting real here. Like, was there, when all of them things were kind of taken away from you, was it quite a quick response to like, right, okay, so I can't do what I normally do. So how, what can I do with this time? Or was it, did you just, because I spoke to so many people about this and, yeah. and some people just kind of went, well, I'm generally touring 24/7. So that's, yeah. that's stopped now. So right, I'm now going to write this record. And they tried to write it straight away and it just wouldn't happen because yeah. they weren't in a, the right creative headspace to do such. Like, how did that work for you? Was it quite a quick thing that you just cracked on, or did you kind of try and process what was happening before you sort of made time for it?
Yeah, so I'm one of those people that I've always got a few plates spinning in the air, and I already had a number of outstanding projects that I could get my teeth into. But I'd be lying if I said for the first 3 months I would like pass out in the middle of the day. And I think it was just some kind of a depression, or just being really traumatized by the whole thing. I think everybody experienced that to some degree, and then it opened up over the summer a little bit, and then it was all, you know, we've all just had to adapt as we go, you know.
Yeah.
But I definitely, yeah, I've got friends and mentors who are like, right, Bishy, this is the time, launch this, launch that. And I'm very active, but I'd be lying if I had said, oh yeah, it was really easy. Like, really, yeah. it really was not easy. And so as a venue owner, like, Is your venue all right? Are you?
Yes. So we're really lucky. My venue's in Essex. It's called the Pink Toothbrush, and it's the sort of longest running alternative club in the UK.
So
it's kind of steeped in history, Bishy. It was like, it used to be called Crocs, and we spoke beforehand of our mutual friend Mark Moore, and that was kind of how my friendship with Mark kind of got moving, really. Was talking about the kind of new romantic scene and how my club was very sort of pivotal in that. And so we're quite lucky because where we're based in Essex, we have no competition. There is nothing that left field or alternative where we live. It's lots of kind of towy type clubs. which isn't really what we're about. And so we've been really lucky that we've just got this kind of diehard following, and they've just stuck with us throughout. And we're really famous for having a really dirty, sticky carpet, which,
I won't ask why.
It's just stale beer and teen spirit. It's just that. Yes. And anybody that's been to the club will always reference that, oh, got stuck to the carpet. And so it's just been this ongoing thing for like 30 years. And so over lockdown, just beforehand, we had our carpets changed, and so we kept it, and we cut it into small pieces and framed it, and we sold like 2,500 framed bits of our sticky carpet, which that was testament to the love and support of our clubbers, and it also meant that it helped pay our bills and to get us through it. So again, just using that kind of like, right, shit, we're in trouble here. How do we get around this? And that punk ethos, DIY kind of mindset of like, what have we got that we can do here? Because we can't open our doors, we can't play records. So yeah, and so we've been really lucky. We sat tight when everybody reopened, when they got the green light. We didn't. We waited a month till bank holiday weekend just to kind of see if there was going to be any glaringly obvious mistakes that everyone was going to make, and we could learn from that. And thankfully, there were no glaringly obvious mistakes. It all seems to be returning to lots of joyous faces with their hands in the air screaming.
Brilliant. So, I'm so happy. Oh my God, that's such a happy ending.
Yeah.
I'm sure you must have gone through bits of that process and been like, fuck. Sorry, can I swear?
Yeah, of course you can. Fuck. Yeah.
You must have sat there and just thought, fuck,
for every Friday and Saturday night for the last 30 years, that's been my home.
Yeah.
And like, and I'd never, like, maybe I'd had like 2 weekends off a year when I'd gone on holiday, and it was like all of a sudden it wasn't there, and it was so strange and so surreal. I'm there tonight, and I literally can't wait to get there, because it's not, I mean, everybody that's there, like, we've got Glass Collective that have worked there 18 years. It's like a real lovely little family, and it shouldn't work, the club, Bishy. It's like, it's this tiny little doorway in this small town, and it's got a ridiculous name, and we play really fucking not loud, abrasive, noisy music, but it works. And it's lovely, because over the last 18 months So many people have turned 18, 19. Sorry, 18, 19. They've never been clubbing.
Yeah. Yes, so I know.
2 years worth of these excited kids that are like, oh my God, this is a nightclub. This is what happens. And it's lovely seeing their faces experience it for the first time as well. So, yeah, I digress. I'm banging on about myself. This isn't what this podcast is about. We're talking about you today.
Okay.
Right, let's start the playlist. Bishy, tell me the song that you think has the greatest ever intro, please.
Well, a song that I think has one of the greatest intros.
No, that's not what I asked. I want that. You can have some honourable mentions. Don't swerve it. Come on.
Okay. So the song with the greatest intro is Ain't No Mountain High Enough by Diana Ross and the Supremes. It's absolutely epic. And my drag queen wife in LA, I saw her lip sync to this once in a club in LA. And it's just always stuck out for me. It's always stuck out. I think it's her spoken word intro and, you know, the softness of her delivery around those words. And then the epicness of the brass and the strings and the orchestra. And I think it was on an advert when I was a kid. I think it was on a DHL advert.
It was.
Right, yeah. So that's where I recognised it from. And I always thought it was epic. And it was those days where there was, you know, it was like in the 90s. So I couldn't like Shazam it or anything. But I remember being in this club in LA and my very glamorous drag queen wife Phyllis lip synced it, and it was beautiful.
Oh, it's a glorious record, and the intro. Once you've heard it once, you know what's coming. You get that payoff because when it drops, oh my God, it's just euphoric, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It keeps going. Euphoria is the word for that song. It keeps going up and up because it's not just the intro. Then it's the chorus, and then it goes even, it modulates in the brass to an even higher key, and you're like, oh, okay, we really are like climbing up the mountain here. So yeah, it's extraordinary.
Have you seen Diana Ross live?
I haven't. Do you know what? I was going to get tickets for
the doing the O2, isn't she?
Yeah. I really want to go. I just think, like, I love divas and the history of kind of 20th, 21st century divadom, but she is up there as being one of the people who created the modern day diva as we know, you know, 100%. And it was growing through the Supremes, so she was definitely sort of schooled during the Motown era, but what happened during the 70s and then her being involved with Nile Rodgers and everything, it just went to this other level. I mean, you had Cher on one side and then you had Diana Ross on the other side. And then you had people like LaBelle who were doing the whole Afrofuturist thing. They were inventing the kind of Afrofuturist diva, whereas Diana Ross was doing the classic diva. Like what we all think is diva is Diana Ross, right? The like big hair, the fishtail skirt, the big furs, the, you know, like ripping your coat open, like all of that kind of stuff, all of that language.
So, I watched, I don't know if you saw it, there was a documentary on about 2 months ago about the Bee Gees.
And, yes.
Did you watch it?
Yeah, love.
Oh, my God. And when they got to, obviously, like, Barry writing for other artists. And for me, growing up, I'm 48, so I think I was probably at that point where I was getting a little bit fussy with my music. And I remember like loving the Supremes, loving Diana Ross. And then Chain Reaction come out and I was just like, oh, I don't know if I like this. This is like pop music. I'm like, I'm too cool for pop music now. Just being a ridiculous tit of a teen. And I watched that documentary and they played that little clip of Chain Reaction. And I just thought, I need to go and re-listen to that. It's amazing. It's such an incredible pop record, Chain Reaction, and it builds and builds and builds. And one of her best vocals as well, I think.
Yeah. But it's interesting because I could imagine the Bee Gees vocals on Chain Reaction as well. And I've noticed that with a lot of the songs that they've written, you can completely imagine them singing it. Like, I didn't realise that they'd written the intro song to Grease, which I think is like, I'm not, you know, I mean, like, I loved the musical as a child, but I still think that intro is a fucking great song.
It's been chosen about three or four times on this podcast.
Really?
Just that, because Frankie Valli performs it, doesn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Just
yeah.
that, yeah. What a call of arms. Do you know
yes,
what I mean?
Yes, absolutely. And another great intro as well. Yeah. And I loved that Bee Gees documentary. I loved it when they had footage of, they recreated the dance floor from Saturday Night Fever.
Yeah.
As their touring stage, that is so great. That, and they all had like choreographed dance moves on it and kind of how they walked on stage. Yeah, I love it. Absolutely love it.
Wonderful. Bishy, track two. I'm going to take you back now. First song that you remember hearing, please, that had an emotional impact on you.
So the first song I remember hearing that had an emotional impact on me was the intro from The Jungle Book by George Bronze. It's absolutely beautiful. It plays on the credits opening the film, and it's an orchestral piece of music, and it just has this sense of mystery and wonder. What I loved about those early Disney films is that there was a darkness, which I think there's quite a lot of darkness in childhood, you know, and you know that you're going to go on a mysterious journey, but it's just kind of beautifully, it's really beautifully like developed. So you have this really intense kind of brass intro, and then I think like the flute comes in, and it's very like hypnotic, like a snake charmer. And then it goes into some really epic kind of Disney 60s strings, and it's really great. I don't know whether you know the piece of music.
I do.
But it's really evocative. I remember I went to BAFTA to see David Arnold in Conversation, and he picked that piece of music. And I hadn't known until then who the composer of that, of all of the orchestral and the incidental music on The Jungle Book was. But yeah, it's very beautiful and very emotional.
What would the emotion have been if you had to pinpoint it?
A sense of melancholy and wonder, because if you think about it, there is a sadness, like there's a transformation in well, certainly I'm talking about, you know, the Disney version of The Jungle Book. So you have a child who's been left in the jungle, and he's brought up by some animals who basically teach him how to be more human. The animals teach Mowgli how to be human, and he teaches the animals how to have more compassion. So you're getting people from opposite ends of the spectrum trying to sort of give each other love. Mm-hmm. And then he gets to a point where they deliver him back to mankind, because he doesn't actually belong in the jungle. He belongs with his own people. But it's that sense of transformation that people from two opposite ends of the spectrum can come together and create change. And even when they go off in their separate directions, they've affected each other. And that's what a great relationship is. It's really emotional when I'm talking about it. Like that's what a good relationship is. You come into each other's life through whatever situation, and you impact each other in a really positive way. It's really emotional. It's really...
So where would you have seen that first? Like, where was home? Where was growing up, Bishy?
So growing up was in West London, in West Kensington, which is where Hanif Qureshi based the Buddha of Suburbia. I grew up in a block of flats, which is opposite a pub that the Sex Pistols played one of their first shows. It's called the King's Arms now. It was called something else. Julian Temple actually interviewed me inside that pub for another film project of his called London, the Modern Babylon. So I remember being a tiny person watching it on a VHS player. And yeah, like in it, speaking of punk, like maybe, I don't know, like you cross the street and then it's the King's Arms. I wish I could remember the name of that pub, but yeah, very much in Punkville. I mean, years after, yeah. You know, but yeah, that's where I grew up.
How was it growing up in West London?
It was a very interesting intersection. I grew up on the intersection of a very, very busy road that took you to the suburbs, which is where all of the Indian community that I grew up around were around. And then, you know, really near the A40 flyover. So then it was really quick to get into town. I feel lucky that I had a lot of I grew up in a, you know, in a very multicultural way. I had really great role models from all different races. And I'm really thankful to my parents for that. They specifically didn't want to live in the suburbs and just be with all of the other Indian people. They specifically, you know, they love this country and they love the opportunity that this country gave. And they just had really interesting friends, you know. So, yeah, my dad had his mates from Essex who had been roadies for The Who. And then, he had his driving license when he was 11 because he drove the president of the Rotary Club in Darjeeling home drunk. But he got his actual license in this country from a really lovely Jamaican guy called Errol. And it's like so many of these friends of theirs are just still friends now. It's really, really amazing. And I just feel really thankful to having such a range of different culture and just really excellent, just like really lovely role models who are still with us to this day.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Track 3, the song that reminds you of your time at school, please.
Track 3, the song that reminds me of my school days is Hyper Ballad by Bjork. So Post came out when I was 12. It's also when I think I'm the generation that the Spice Girls was aimed at. But I had a very cool older sister who was playing me Sonic Youth and Hole and got me into alternative stuff. So I was buying Select magazine and reading MME and Melody Maker.
Select
and
posters on the wall?
Yes.
Obviously.
Absolutely, yeah. Obviously. But so a very cool older sister of a friend introduced me to Bjork's debut. So maybe I was 10, 11 when debut came out. So I rather than being Spice Girls generation, I'm generation Bjork. I remember loving Venus as a Boy and knowing it was like sexual, but not really knowing why. And, you know, and so, yeah, I mean, Bjork and Skin from Skunk and Nancy, watching them do Army of Me on Top of the Pops was next level. You know, everything we're talking about in music in terms of women, inclusivity, or like alternative narratives, like really alternative women, really take it, like dominating that space. And
no more so.
Just extraordinary, yeah.
For the Brit Awards, when Bjork and Polly Harvey done Satisfaction, completely stripped down, just Polly playing the guitar. Oh my God, I remember just thinking, this is exciting. And like, and this is the stuff that your parents are just like, what's this? Like, and it's like, good, it ain't for you. This is for us. Like,
Yeah, absolutely. And I remember watching the Hyper Ballad video. It must have been on whatever kids TV. And those Michel Gondry, that, you know, we talk about sort of hyperpop and NFTs. And when you look at the kind of artwork and visuals that are doing really well on Instagram and TikTok. But it's kind of what Michel Gondry was doing with Bjork in 1995. It's absolutely extraordinary. And there again, it's another song that builds. Maybe there's a theme going on with my song choices that it starts, you know, it starts small and then gets bigger and then gets bigger and bigger. And that's kind of what the video does as well. And it just had a massive impact on the kind of artist that I've really sought to be.
Was you always, because like you say, you was that sort of Spice Girls, you know, mid-90s generation.
Yeah.
In those formative years. What was it that kind of, I mean, did you like the Spice Girls as well? I should say that I'm about to kind of just go, you know, did that have any impact on you? But
yeah. So no, they weren't my thing. But of course, I still went to see Spice World on Boxing Day because that's what all school girls did. And I'm not going to lie and say that, like, I didn't think it was fun. And also, my older sister was mates with some members of Sonic Youth and they loved the Spice Girls. One of them had a Spice Girls t-shirt. Jim O'Rourke had a Spice Girls t-shirt that he wore all the time. And as I've got older, I respect what these four pretty like down to earth, like I hate to use the ordinary, but just three regular women. Mm-hmm. Five regular women. I can't count. Five regular women who, you know, weren't from any posh backgrounds, didn't, you know, really like five regular women took over the world and what they must have gone through. And that's how I view it now. Like, it's not, I never loved the music. It's not really for me. But what they endured as women, I have absolute respect for.
But as a young woman, you know, in those sort of teen years when it would make sense that everybody would be drawn to the kind of super colourful pop stuff that's being pushed upon you, what was it about the likes of Bjork and Kim Gordon and people like that and Courtney Love that made you think, no, actually, this is a bit of me?
And Justine Frisham as well. Oh. Yeah, I think because I just got an authenticity and a power. I taught myself the bass guitar. I just felt there was more depth and a bit more weight to what they were doing. And there was more music. There was darkness and depth. I felt that I identified with their tropes of power. I felt like it made me, absorbing their music made me feel like I could be more of myself, even though I didn't necessarily know what that is, you know? And so like I was going to school in Baker Street and I'd route back through Soho and there would be, you know, there was that poster, like there was that vintage poster shop. So there would be shots of the Ronettes and Emma Peel. And obviously, yeah, there were all of those cheap bookstores with all of those Taschen books. So I would look, I would sit and flick through the Thierry Mugler book and the Jean-Paul Gaultier book. And on Sunday, the Sunday Times Style, it was edited by Isabella Blow, who I met, and, you know, and Philip Treacy, who I've also met, and Nick Knight, who I've been shot by. And so there was this really powerful, definitive couture imagery, and it just spoke to me. It made me feel like I could be more of myself. More than the Spice Girls, but it's all right. You're allowed to like bits of popular culture and really avant culture. And I think we've got to a nice place where you can like a bit of quote unquote, like shit TV, you know, like you can still enjoy British Bake Off, but then you can enjoy like a really weighty documentary on David Lynch on Mubi, but I can still like Great British Bake Off and Gogglebox. Like, do you know what I mean? I think it's good for everyone to have a little bit of both. But yeah, it's just more like the darkness and the authority, and also from women playing their own instruments that appeal to me more.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you mentioned that it's all right to like that, and it was okay to like Elastica, and it was okay to like the Spice Girls at the same time. Yeah. For me, it felt, I was probably like 18, 19 around the mid 90s, and it was an incredible time to be an indie kid, which I was. Yeah. And it felt like, you know, everything was super exciting, but it also felt,
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Quite tribal, in regards to like the youth cultures were quite sort of defined, you know. It'd be like, right, there's a raver, that kid's a Britpop kid, you know, that kid's like a metalhead. And for somebody that still runs a venue, I don't see them kind of that kind of tribalism in music so much now.
No.
Like, do you know what I mean? I wonder what your thoughts are on that, that kind of, that, you know, the, because we see so many kind of like, you know, galleries opening with these, you know, huge exhibitions of like youth culture, you know, and I just think where is it now? Maybe I'm too old to know. I don't know. It feels to me that it's far more blurred now. And I guess that could be a good thing and a bad thing. I just wonder what your thoughts are on it.
Yeah, definitely. When it comes to music, I think people are a lot more open-minded. And not that they weren't open-minded before. They were just very tribal, like you like two-tone or you like dance music or you like this. And, of course, all of the nerds and the crate diggers and people who are just into music just, like, love music because they love music. I think maybe that kind of tribalism has gone into things like gender and sexuality, and it's all on social media and it's, you know, which I think having more variety is great, and I'm on everybody's side and I'm on the side of the underdog and blah, blah, blah. But in terms of that kind of tribalism, I think identity has gotten very tribal in a way that I think that the variety is great, but the kind of the inbred arguing and the kind of cancellations and the, I think Annie Clark, who's like one of my great, you know, great modern heroines, I can't quite remember the words that she used, but she didn't want to use the words cancel culture. Maybe I'm like, you know, let me think of the best way to talk about this, because it's like there's definitely tribalism and it is quite scary what's going on. It is scary. Like, people are very sort of at each other's throats at the moment. And I think that, I think things like nightclubs, you know, I was one of the last generations to experience really cheap rent, the early days of the internet with cheap rent and everyone going out every night of the week. You know, I mentor a lot of young producers and young artists and young bands, and they always ask me how I did it. And it's like, I just went out every night, and you see people out every night. And what they don't really understand is that the queer scene, the indie kids, the goths, the fetish scene, the rock and rollers, we were all just alternative and everybody just kind of went to each other's parties.
Yeah.
It didn't really matter. Like, we didn't really need the kind of rules. There are a lot of clubs that have a lot of rules now, and I understand why, but it was so hard to find your tribe back then that we were all mixing it up and going to like mad squat parties in East London and Peckham, and people were breaking into places. There used to be this mini cab office on the city road that my friends always broke into. There were always just like, you know, like fashion designers, people at art college, people showing their collections, bands playing. There was this real cultural osmosis, and I felt like I was one of the last generations to really experience that. And I was talking to some members from Big Joni, because we're all around the same age. And you're like, yeah, that sweet spot of like Wi-Fi and cheap rent. And everyone had a shit job, but it was fine because you just went out every night and it was brilliant, you know? Yeah.
And so before we move on, just to sort of stay on school for a little bit.
Yes.
How was school?
I didn't have a very good time. I went to a girls' school. There are a lot of incredibly wealthy girls there, and it was very cutthroat in terms of like all the rich girls sat on the top of the pyramid, and it's sort of subconsciously all of the like more, all of the poorer and all of the like young girls of color, like everybody was further down the pyramid, and it was mercenary, and I fucking hated it. But however, what was great was that I started playing in bands when I was 14, and I was discovered, quote unquote, discovered by the performance art band Minty, who were founded by the late Lee Bowery. And so I entered into this very alternative world of queerness and performance art and people doing drag and people, you know, people gender bending with identity in a way that was, you know, for me, it was like, I just wanted to find who's the version of Andy Warhol's factory. And I kind of ended up entering into that world. The whole Goldie metalheads Asian underground thing, I was just that little bit too young, but I did know, or, you know, I did know the key members of the Asian underground. Now they're my friends, you know, and I felt very lucky. I feel like I've had a very one-off experience in terms of, like, you know, I did go to metalheads like really underage once, because it would go off in the afternoon and then carry off into the evening. And I remember those early days of Hoxton Square where there really were just two Tesco bags blowing around in the wind. There was like nothing. It was a no man's land. And I feel very lucky that I experienced all of that. And I was really taken care of. My older friends and my kind of disco family, my drag family, really looked after me.
Tell me a little bit more about, you said that you got pulled into the world of Minty. This interests me a hell of a lot. I have an episode that I recorded in lockdown with Matthew, isn't it? Matthew, yes. And who was the other member?
Richard Torrey.
Richard and Matthew. Yeah. So I have what started off as being an hour-long episode become a five-hour episode.
I bet.
Which I then went, I'm going to give this back to you and you can edit it as to what you want to have kept in it. And it was bananas. I saw Minty. Again, I'm a big fan of Barry. And I saw Minty, and it, to this day, was probably still one of the most surreal things I've ever experienced in my life. Supporting Pulp, actually. But tell me about your involvement in that.
Yeah, so I came onto the scene after Lee Bowery had passed away, and I think they'd just come off the Pulp tour, and they were just in the process of releasing that record. And I think behind the scenes, obviously, they lost their leader, so it was very, very fraught. But in terms of me, they were just really nice and really supportive to me. I didn't actually play with them at the time. It was more like they just took me, Matthew took me to a lot of parties and introduced me to a lot of people. I think he could see that there was this powerful young woman and that she needed encouragement and she needed guidance. I mean, he was certainly in that headspace then. You know, he was very, very nurturing. He's very good at being able to see people struggle with their potential and to look at them and encourage them to be more of themselves. And so he was really brilliant. And we were involved. We set up a classical music nightclub called the Siren Suite. And we opened for Goldfrapp and Pulp. And that was when I was at St. Martin's doing my foundation then. And we set up another club called Cashpoint, which was like the precursor to this massive kind of, you know, huge explosion of queerness that we see now. It's
Cashpoint was a big deal.
Like, yeah,
don't skirt over that. Cashpoint was a big deal, did you?
Yeah. So I was the main DJ there, and I helped co-founded it or whatever they say now. That was a really big deal. And the how big sort of queerness and queer culture, how mainstream it is now, the roots of that was all really going on around clubs like Cashpoint and Nag 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 and the whole Electro Clash thing. But what I loved about that era is there was a lot of crossover with the indie scene. We had people from the fetish scene, the film scene. You know, we had all of that, like Libertines, Baby Shambles lot. It's just because sort of at that point, Matthew knew everybody. Mm. And so everybody just sort of came to his clubs. And that's something that I really liked about Matthew. He had this cross-section of people, you know, back then. He was friends with this cross-section of different people in London, and he was very good at bringing all of those people together. So that's something that really appealed with, you know, appealed to me about our relationship. And yeah, it was a, yeah, it's been a one-off experience, Stu.
For somebody that was trying to do something alternative and different out in Essex, I would look in at what was happening there and it was like, that's what I want to be.
You think
that's perfect right there, that hybrid of scenes all coming together. It just felt really exciting looking in at that. And I think for us at that point, we're probably going through a more kind of, because it was more just straight up kind of indie alternative music. It was hit a, I don't know. It just felt like we was like not quite where we should be. And I'd look in at what you guys were doing and it was like, oh, wow, that looks so exciting. I want a bit of that.
Yeah, it was mental, but brilliant, brilliant. Mm. What an experience to have, you know?
Okay, track four. The first song you remember buying from a record shop, please, Bishy.
The first song I remember buying from a record shop, I bought the Beatles 1962 to 66 from Gawler Market in Calcutta when I was there on holiday in India. And my mum's a singer and she was recording an album. And I remember her, we bought this cassette tape together. And she said, these guys are going to keep you. They're going to be your friends when I'm away. And she's absolutely right. They were my friends. I was convinced.
What an amazing thing to say to your kid.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
So good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I thought, you know, when I used to watch those Beatles films when I was a kid, I seriously thought they were my best friends. I was absolutely convinced. And then it turns out years later that I've actually worked with Sean Lennon. I recorded on one of his horror movie soundtracks and we've actually kind of written material together and become friends, which is, you know, he's been a great supporter and a great advocate for my music. And yeah, it's all nice how these things come round together. But yeah, that album, I know you asked for song, but it was the first thing that
yeah,
I bought.
That's fine.
And it was really emotional. I loved all of the material. Obviously, when Yesterday came on, I felt a bit teary. I mean, obviously, you know, like even not really understanding what then quite happened to the Beatles and to John Lennon. I felt very emotional when Yesterday came on. I think when my mum was recording her album, I remember when Yesterday came on, I sort of wished I could talk to her on the phone. It was like, I want to talk to my mum. But yeah, I just think, you know, I see on social media a lot of people love to like bash the Beatles, or there are loads of like anti-Beatles memes all over social media. And I just always write the same thing in the comments, just like, you fucking idiots. These are the first people to really put Indian culture on the global map. You know, prior to the Beatles, the West went over there for business purposes. They were there to do business. The Beatles went over as artists to learn about a culture, and they re-put that culture back on the map. And, you know, like another name drop, but Anushka Shankar is also a friend of mine who's really supported me and advocated for my music. I've played her festival over the summer on the South Bank, and you know, they put a lot of good things into the world, and I'm over people slagging it off because they think it's boomer or they're just too fucking lazy to do any research. Yeah. So that's my soapbox.
No, that's so true. And as well, I just think, how many bands can you look at that existed in the time frame that the Beatles existed in and put out that amount of prolific work, and not one album sounded like the one that come before it?
Exactly.
You know, within a matter of years, you go from Twist and Shout to fucking Tomorrow Never Knows. It's like, come on. Like,
I've never
understood that kind of bashing the Beatles thing. It's like, you don't like anything that the Beatles have ever done. It's like, come on, don't believe you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think also learning about their recording techniques, so they would have to play everything from start to finish perfectly, and obviously, you know, you can hear it with the Helter Skelter, I've got blisters on my fingers, it's like take 69 or like whatever number take it is. I've actually read quite extensively into how they recorded this stuff, and I think the book's somewhere on my bookshelf back there, but they got the Kaiser Chiefs in to try the same recording techniques as the Beatles, and they were almost crying. Like, they had 4 hours to get this one song right, and they were really at the edge of everything. And they got the take, but it really taught them just how perfect you had to be in those analog recording days, or just the kind of, like, just how limited they were technologically and what they've managed to achieve and how good it still sounds now. It's fine. Like, it's really nerdy chat. Not like, I know, like, most musicians and nerds and sound people, everybody respects them because of what they actually created. But I'm over the anti-Beatles memes, because I just think, you know, most of the people who laugh at them think they're really progressive. And it's like, well, if you think you're progressive, then you should know that these four guys from Liverpool, they're again like just normal dudes from Liverpool. There's something in them, like India appealed to them, and they would have gone when India was in quite a difficult time politically, and they went there as students of a culture. So, and that affects me, that it's affected everybody, but it certainly affects me in terms of like putting Indian culture on a world stage from a really beautiful perspective.
Okay. Track five it is now. I'm going to ask you to tell me, please, the song that soundtracked your year's clubbing.
The song that soundtracked my year's clubbing, I'd say Get Your Freak On, Missy Elliott.
That's a tune, isn't it?
It's, I mean, just incredible. So that kind of early aughts, that Timbaland, the early Neptunes, Aaliyah, Missy Elliott, Mary J. Blige. It's a very different sound palette to everything I've picked, which is why I decided to go for this song in particular. But, I mean, my God, what they were doing production-wise, what they were doing with their looks, with their videos. There again, like 20 years on, it still looks and sounds like the future. You know, I'm on TikTok and I watch reels and stuff, and you've got a new generation and they're completely remixing all of that Missy Elliott stuff. And it's not that they're, you know, that they're just dancing to it. They're doing other things. They're doing really interesting things with their looks, and they're doing really interesting things choreography wise. But that's the power of that, of Missy Elliott, is that 20 years later, people are still referencing and remixing it. And I think she did a performance at the VMAs like a couple of years ago. I mean, it just absolutely blew me away. She's, I don't know if you've seen it, but the last scene is insane. So they've got this Roswell scene where there's a spaceship over the arena stage, and then there are like people dressed as scarecrows and her on the top of the hay bale in some insane straw hat and like a farmer's outfit, like really rapping. And then this alien falls out of the spaceship. It's like, what were they smoking? This is so amazing. Not just from the choreography and from the production point of view, but what were the initial like show production meetings? It's like, so we've got this, you know, like, we've got this idea. She's going to start in a mirrored hallway with a load of, like, femme sex bots. And then we're going to blow her up and she'll fall into the audience. And then she's going to be rapping on a hay bale. Like, what the fuck, you know? It, absolutely incredible. Actually, in lockdown, I got masterclass and I did Timbaland's beat-making masterclass.
Okay. Yeah.
That's what a fan I am. And yeah, I actually, you know what? I think she follows me on Twitter. I think I should send her my music, right?
100%. 100%. Why have you done it already?
Yeah, no, I know. I there again, they were using kind of Arabic music. I think from what I remember, her and Timbaland had their studio above an Arabic barber's, or like, you know, like it was in a very kind of like multicultural bit. I don't know what American city they were, but they had this tiny studio and they would overhear the sounds from the cassettes and from people's different cabs and stuff. And And I think the guy, when the thing's, oh, Demogico, they asked him to say, can you sing Get Your Freak On? And he was like, no, I don't really do that, you know. So he just sang that. And I know that Timbaland's sound palette, he's very into like non-Western scales. And, you know, he was able to capture the spirit of Asia and the Middle East through hip hop at that time, like better than a lot of us could do it. Yeah. And I think that speaks to the power of like cultural subversion. And sometimes other people can look into your culture and see something special and, you know, use it, appreciate it in a way that you can't do it for yourself.
Totally.
It's a banging tune.
Oh, it really is. I mean, before you got into sort of DJing at clubs and you just, you know, in the kind of early years of going clubbing, what did you want from a night out?
Oh, well, being friends with Matthew Glamour, I think what I wanted was people looking amazing. I think sounds I'd never heard. I think, you know, the other record that I was going to put in and then I went to Missy Elliott was Where's Your Head At? Basement Jacks, because that really reminds me of like when I really started clubbing, kind of school days. You know, I was really underage, and we'd go to Soho. I'd go to Camden in the Stables Market. They had like, you know, 5 vintage garments for 20 quid. So, you know, you could pick up some incredible labels and some incredible items of clothing, like 5 for 20 quid. So, you know, and then we'd dress up and then we'd either go to the Astoria or we'd go all the way down Soho. We'd go and see live bands in Camden and then sort of end up in house parties in East London. I wasn't really doing the South London thing that much yet, but that really brings back that being very underage, getting into clubs anyway, because all girls read and are just a lot more mature than teenage boys. You know, really, yeah, like vodka, lemon and limes and Smirnoff Ice. Oh, my God, it's all coming back now. But, yeah, and you know, there again, I'd mix it up going to all of the gay clubs, going to GAY. Yes, I'm admitting that. Going to more of the underground gay clubs, kind of Madame Jojo's. But then going to things like Club Kitten and, like, you know, Dingwalls and just really, really absorbing. I think that film Velvet Goldmine had just come out. And so there was that sort of appreciation back for glam rock. And then it was the end of the Britpop thing. But then all of that kind of garbage Nine Inch Nails stuff was happening. And then all of that, you know, all of that dance music, Basement Jacks, Chemical Brothers, all of that was coming up when I started underage clubbing, and it was just really exciting.
Was you confident?
Yes and no. I think confidence is a multi-leveled, it's like a tiered cake, isn't it? So I definitely had a lot of guts in terms of I knew what I wanted. I knew what I wanted to go for. But I think your self-esteem and your confidence is like an ever-changing thing. And you just have to work with it. So, yeah, I had massive insecurities then. I'm more aware of the things that I'm insecure and I'm scared of now. And I try and treat it with a bit more love and respect. Everyone's going through it, right?
100%.
Yeah.
100%. Well, take you home. Track 6. Favourite song from an artist from your home county, please.
My favourite song by an artist from my home county, I thought about this long and hard, it's Lady Stardust by David Bowie. And it's because I grew up so close to the Hammersmith Palais, which is obviously where the last Ziggy Stardust show was. It's a beautiful song. It's a really hard song to sing as well. Bowie was such a fantastic vocalist. I think what I love about Lady Stardust is, there again, it has queerness and gender and live music and people getting up on stage and performing. And those 4 things are huge to my story and huge to my experience, even though this song was written, like, you know, definitely a decade, at least a decade before I was born, there's something about what the whole Ziggy phenomenon encapsulates in terms of the effect that it's had on all of us, really. Although I prefer late Bowie, I prefer his Berlin period, and, you know, I'm lucky, so lucky that I worked with Tony Visconti, and you know, I have him as a friend and a mentor. There's something about that song that I think is very evocative and emotional, and the lyrics are beautiful as well. Really, really beautiful.
I want to ask you in a moment about working with Tony Visconti, because let's not just brush over that. tell me about your relationship with London. Like, how's that changed over the years? Have you fallen out of love with London and fallen back in love with London? How's the relationship been?
No, I love London, but I really don't think it's the way that things are. It's become a city for the super rich, and it's just become so expensive. I'm lucky. I have roots here. I have family here. And I find it hard. So I think if I find it hard, what does someone who's moved here or someone who's had to set up shop from another town or another country, what are they going through? You know, the things that I love about this city, the small grassroots venues, the small tiny boutiques, those small pockets that you can go to and sort of live. It's still full of interesting people and interesting things, and there's stuff to do every day of the week. And I love that. But, you know, the rent is so expensive. Just basic living has become so difficult for people. And I really mourn that. It's like everything has just become one giant members club, you know, and it didn't used to be like that. I think explaining to people what pre-gentrified London was like, yes, it was dangerous, and no, it wasn't fancy, and no, you couldn't have a latte on every street corner, and, you know, you did have to wait for very shit buses and shit areas, and, you know, there was an element of danger. And I don't think that's just because I was a teenager or a young woman. There was, you could really feel the tinge of danger. Like, I remember living in Haggerston kind of long before it was the, like, Haggerston slash what some people call Faggerston. That's probably RPC, lol. But yeah, just when you look at some of the footage for, you know, like, we'd run around the streets of East London making pop videos and stuff, and when you see what it was like, yeah, it was dangerous. I had a guitarist who was a Dior model, and so he looked like a girl. I mean, he was quite amazing looking, and, you know, people tried to beat him up right outside my flat where I lived in Haggerston. Of course, now he would just be applauded for, like, looking so androgynous. That's the irony. But it was rough, you know, it was dangerous. But there was the freedom in terms of, you know, once, like the girls from Big Joni, it's like we were all fine just having a shit job a couple of days a week in some vintage shop that, you know, like no one really understood, like, how it was there. Like, you know, like, we were fine all doing little jobs here and there, and then the majority of our week we'd be able to be creative or, like, explore more creative endeavors. And as I say, like, the young, you know, artists and producers and people that I mentor now, that you have to have a full-time job all the time and be, you know, being a slave to a Spotify algorithm where you're supposed to have a new song and a new video and a new campaign every 6 weeks. It's like, how the fuck do you manage that, you know? And I think this is all keyed into the just how expensive everything has got in London. And so I mourn and lament that. And I think that why I'm so passionate about creative people getting together, like, you know, podcasts, people getting together and having a space just to talk a bit, in some kind of, like, one-to-one, like, you know, like, even though, like, we are, like, on Zoom now, this is a real conversation. Sure. And the reason that I favor this is because it's making up for all of those spaces that I feel have gone.
I think the one thing that I love about podcasting, and just quickly, Bishi, everything you just said there, I completely agree with, and I think you put that so well then.
Thank you.
And for me, I watch, growing up watching so many music shows that no longer exist, and there's very few music shows even on the television anymore.
Yeah.
And what I do think is missing from television and radio is long form conversation. And if you get somebody that you're really excited about that are going to be on Graham Norton or Jonathan Ross, unfortunately, I mean, there's a place for them shows.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Listen, I've watched them for years, and that's cool. But come in, sit down, tell us an anecdote, have a quick chat with the guests that are sitting next to you, what you plug in, next guest. Don't get anything from that. And like... Yeah. And it always just seems very fast. And I watch my kids' thumbs on their phones, and they're super fast. And it's like, maybe it's just my age, I don't know. But I like the idea of a podcast. It's like, right, well, look, for the next hour, we can just have a chat. And like, and I think there's something really nice about that. And I think that's one of the things that's definitely made, you know, podcasting become what it has, which is this huge thing now that you know, I think ultimately will eclipse radio. And because people, there's so much more choice now, and you can literally find something that is exactly what you're into. If you're into somebody that's basket weaving in the Andes, I'm sure there's a podcast. Do you know what I mean?
Like, I'd listen to that. That sounds great. Yeah. I think, well, I mean, I've done bits for Radio 4 as well. So there's definitely an art form to that, which I really appreciate. But I think that there's a sense of connection that just normal conversation between people is so fascinating. You know, I did an Instagram live last night with the writer Nikesh Shukla. And one of the beautiful things that he says is that in his writing, he finds the extraordinary in the ordinary. And that's what a lot of podcasting is. It's just these extraordinary anecdotes. And like, I think, you know, very often when we talk about growing up, you can like sometimes really live in your pain and kind of live with like some difficult memories. But in this conversation, there's this whole other side that like I'm talking about more and more, but it is like being an underage clubber in the late 90s, just at the dawn of the internet, being one of the first generations to really utilize the internet and have a career basically as a result. And there's a lot of excitement and joy and happiness and just like fucking hilariousness that I know is there, you know, and I know that all of the shadow and like all of the difficult stuff is there as well. But it's really nice through music to remember all of the hilarious and all of the great stuff.
Wonderful.
Because there was so much of it.
Well, Bishi, for the last track, you get to go back to your DJing days and play Tastemaker and introduce someone to something new. And so for that track, I'm going to ask you please to tell me a song that you think many people may not know that you would like them to hear.
So many of you may not know that the song I would love you to hear is Le Fleur by Minnie Riperton. But there again, another absolutely epic song with this beautiful, sensual, like breathy delivery. And even the lyrics are really abstract as well. It's very abstract, but you know what it is. You know a song like Le Fleur encapsulates that moment of like you're just having a massive out breath, you know, or something's just clicked, or you know, or I don't know, like if you go on long walks and or you're sitting by the sea and just something clicks. You know, you've been really struggling with something and it's this massive like eureka moment of, right, I understand this. And that's what Le Fleur is. And it's, I think it was on a KFC advert. It's another hilarious, it's like, how did that end up on that advert? And I remember singing it to my boyfriend at the time and he knew what it was. And so I think I think it encapsulates that. I think there's something about love and about finding oneself and about finding connection. And that's what Le Fleur is. And it's so sad because Minnie Riperton died when she was 30 and she was Maya Rudolph's mother, which I had no idea. I thought that was so amazing. And the whole, you know, there again, like Minnie Riperton was very different because she was like a black hippie. You know, I love that front cover of her and she's got the flower crown and she's by the lion. A lot of people have tagged me in that. And then on the front cover of Come Into My Garden where she's, you know, yeah, she's like a black pagan, which is quite an amazing, I can't think of a female singer before Minnie Riperton who quite had that trope. I mean, yeah, Minnie Riperton was a genius and she was an original and she was a pioneer, but she was also playing with the trope that I don't think had really been played with before, certainly by an African-American woman. And what a loss. Do you know what I mean? What a loss. What an incredible, incredible singer. And that kind of vocal range that then, you know, Mariah Carey came along in the early 90s, like, there again, someone whose music I don't love, but as a kind of a woman and an entity who exists, I think is just quite bonkers and quite amazing in her own right. Mm. You know, that she has probably the same vocal range as Minnie Riperton. So just incredible, incredible song.
Bishy, we put together a Spotify playlist to accompany the pod chat so people can go and listen to all of the records that we've spoken about today. As we kind of heading into the sort of latter part of 2021, which hopefully is going to be a far more happier, connected and better place than what the beginning of 2021 was. With that in mind, what are you looking forward to from the rest of this year personally, and what's going to be happening professionally?
So personally, oh, that's a really good question. I think the personal and the professional are kind of really interlinked. But yeah, let me try and take this from a really personal point of view. I think, I'm in the process of making a sound and video installation for Coventry City of Culture, and it's going to be installed along the canal basin on 5 screens. So I'm really personally just artistically really enjoying the process. I've co-produced it with Richard Norris from The Grid, and I've got Hazel O'Connor doing some spoken words. I've not really announced this yet, but fuck it, you know. And I've written it for piano, sitar, and violin and electronics. I've got some brilliant two brilliant film composers, Anna Phoebe, who's playing violin, and Alexandra Hamilton Ayres, who's a pianist, and they're doing those parts. It's like a really epic, like nearly 10 minute piece. And Hazel O'Connor is doing some spoken words. So just personally, just getting all of that together, that has just been so amazing. And I was in the ruins of Coventry Cathedral the other day doing some 3D modeling on a polycam. So it's going to look very futuristic. And from a personal perspective, there's there's nothing greater than being creative. There's just nothing beyond that. And I really hope that now the travel ban is lifting in the US, that I can go and see my best friend in LA and my sister in Austin, Texas. That's totally personal. But professionally, I've got my third studio album coming out on October the 15th. There's a launch at the Purcell Room on October the 13th. I'm playing at Anushka Shankar's Festival in Hamburg, and I'm opening for Garbage in Bournemouth on the 17th of November. That's, you know, that's all just dream come true. I've written a choral piece for 200 kids in East London, based on their emotions that they went through feeling lonely in lockdown. So I based all of the lyrics in that. So I've got all of that stuff happening. And I feel really lucky that in a difficult period that amazing projects came to me. And it's meant everything to me.
Bishi, if people want to kind of not miss out on any of the things that you've just listed there, where's the best place to kind of keep up to speed with what you're up to?
So I'm most active on my Instagram, which is instagram.com/BishiOfficial. Also bishi.co.uk. I update my, I've got a link tree, which is linktree.com/BishiOfficial, all one word. But yeah, Instagram's the most active place to, you know, all my website are the most active place to look out for these things. Also on my Spotify profile as well. I think I should say that. Yeah.
Bishi, this has been one of my favourite ever episodes I've ever recorded.
I'm so happy.
It's been absolute joy.
Oh, no, it's made me really happy as well. Just the power of talking about music and talking about live music and why that is so important to people. Yeah. It never fails, does it?
Never. Don't go anywhere. I'm going to wrap up the podcast, but don't go anywhere. Right. Bishi, honestly, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Right. I have never done this before, and I am going to drop in a segment before the outro because, well, am I even going to do the outro first and then mention that I'm going to do this? Yeah, that's what I'm going to do. And so I mentioned in the conversation that I wanted to speak about Bishi working with Tony Visconti. We finished the podcast about half an hour ago, and I've just been banging on about some Britpop memories and some guests that I've had on. We've been having a lovely natter, and then it's just dawned on me that I never got round to having that chat about Bishi working with Tony. So you're back.
Hello, I'm back. It's too good. They're just too good stories to not talk about, you know?
Let's do it.
Yeah.
Well, how did it come about?
So I was at a party in Dalston, and I ended up playing in a party band with a guy called Malcolm. And Malcolm is manager to the singer and fashion heiress, goddess, Daphne Guinness. And he said to me that he was working with Tony Visconti and would I like to come over to Ireland and hang out with them and maybe record. And I sort of took it off the cuff. Like within a week, I was up in Daphne's penthouse in Mayfair in her wardrobe, which is the most incredible wardrobe. You know,
imagine.
We're talking like Iris van Herpen and McQueen Couture original. So I have been in that. That is probably the best wardrobe I've ever seen. And then the week after that, I was on an easy jet because I'm fly. I was on an easy jet to Ireland and I got driven out to the estate that they were at and recording at. And obviously, like Tony Visconti is one of my all-time record producing heroes. I've been obsessed with the work that he's recorded with Bowie, T-Rex, Sparks, Hazel O'Connor, just everyone really. And I honestly had no expectation. I knew as a session musician that I had to just get it right. You know, I just had to, Tony's one of those producers that he's, you know, you've got to get it in one take. You know, they don't really stand for anything else. And so it went ridiculously well. I trained with the Bulgarian. Oh my God, was I? Yeah, yeah. I was really nervous. And I don't usually get starstruck, but inside I was like, oh my God. And I trained with the Bulgarian choir as a teenager. And so that influence is really in my singing. And I was singing some backing vocals. And I just remembered the look in his face. He sat back from his chair. And I knew that I'd impressed him, which was amazing. And he's very charming. He's a great storyteller, great raconteur. He's funny. You know, he just kind of oozes like so much charisma. And it was really lovely because over the course of the 3 or 4 days, you know, we ate together and we'd chat and we went on walks together and, you know, and it was all very pleasant. And then after he heard me sing, we really bonded over this Bulgarian choral style. And he revealed to me that he almost got the opportunity to produce Hounds of Love with Kate Bush, but then she decided that she was going to do it herself. You know, he's just full of these incredible stories. And I gave him a copy of my second album, Albion Voice. And I thought, it's cool. Like, he's so famous. He must have musicians approach him all the time. You know, didn't think anything of it. I went to a rave in Cornwall, didn't sleep for 3 days. And I got back home and I had this email. And he was just told me he thought my music was stunning and pleased to keep in touch with him if ever I was in New York, to look him up, to get together. And then I wrote back to him and I said, I haven't had any sleep at this rave in Cornwall. And it was quite rockabilly, but quite rave. But, you know, then there were loads of rock and rollers and there was no security anywhere. And it was really wild. And he just wrote to me back and he said, well, why doesn't anyone invite me to these parties anymore? And so that birthed a friendship. I was his plus one when they opened the Visconti studio down in Kingston University, and just this really beautiful friendship opened up. I went to his studio in New York in the very chair that Bowie sat whilst they were mixing and editing Black Star. Wow. And I got a masterclass in how they made Lodger, because he was remixing Lodger at the time. So we took apart all of the tracks from Lodger and he played me the individual takes. And I heard Bowie's like naked vocal exposed, singing some of the tracks from Lodger, and I have never experienced anything like that. I walked from kind of Flatiron all the way to Bushwick. I walked, and that is a long ass walk. And I just couldn't sleep properly. I felt like I was flying because I had heard Bowie's one take vocals. He is such an incredible vocalist. And you know, and Tony was really teaching me about different production methods. And then he asked me how I produced music. And well, actually, no, he asked me how I wrote music. And I said, well, I've got a home studio. I've got sitars, pianos, synths. I've got my bass guitar. I've got, you know, like various other like bits of equipment. And he said to me, oh, so you're a producer. And I was like, oh, I don't think, he said, no, Bishy, that's what a producer is. That is exactly how a producer works. And you must tell everybody that you're a producer. And I said to him, I feel unconfident about my technical knowledge. And he had this rack of Eventide, like different plugins, like different toys. And he tapped it and he said, oh, that there. He was like, oh, that's easy. You can learn that anytime. Come on, you can learn that. And that would just absolutely change my life. And he was like, you must tell everybody you're a producer, you know. And I had the same masterclass when he remixed the Space Oddity for 50 years of the moon landings. So he took me through the entire track of Space Oddity and taught me where all the microphone placements were. You know, there's the really epic bit of the orchestra that fades out at the end of the original one. He had sort of repositioned that. And so you had more of that in the mix. And he taught me about how they placed all of the, where David was in the room and how they placed all of the microphones. And yeah, I made this song called Don't Shoot the Messenger and I sent it to him and I said, would you be interested in producing this? And he said, yes. And what I was amazed about is that he loved what I consider like quite shit production. He loved it. He used it in the fabric of his production. And you know, being in the studio and working with him, it's like Jedi training with Obi-Wan Kenobi. Like, we had a photographer capturing, we had some students from Kingston University who were training up, in one engineer. There was a very small team of us, and everybody was mesmerized because it is like you are Jedi training, yeah, like with a master. And we work really well together. We know we want to work again together. We know that that's on the cards. And, you know, he has been nothing but totally encouraging of me as a songwriter, as a producer, as a performer. And it's been life-changing.
Oh, wonderful. Well, I mean, I got goosebumps when you was talking about Lodger. That absolutely blew my mind. I'm so glad that we revisited this and just managed to get this chat in, because it's just added to an already incredible pod chat with you. Honestly, Bishy, thank you so much.
Thank you, Stu. I want to come to Crocs.
Whenever you want. There you go. Thought we had finished. Nope, we went back. We had to revisit that. I'm so glad we did. Oh, working with Tony Visconti, hearing isolated David Bowie vocals. Oh, my God, what a moment that is. Goosebumps again just saying it. Oh, I had such a lovely chat. Like, how interesting was Bishy? Like, fascinating. Well, I hope you lot got as much joy listening as I did having that chat. Thanks ever so much for supporting the podcast. I really, really appreciate that. As I mentioned at the beginning as well, go check out the back catalogue, because there's 350 episodes with some of your favourite musicians, producers, DJs, actors, comedians. Go have a rummage, see what you can find. And I'll be back next time. Everything you need to know about this podcast, your one-stop shop, off the beat and track podcast.com. See you next time. Bye-bye.
It's Off the Beat and Track Podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. Me, Stu Whiffin.